We spend just a few moments this evening reading a couple of passages, one from the Old and the other from the New, back to back. The first, Ecclesiastes in chapter 3. The book of Ecclesiastes, the third chapter, beginning at verse number 1. We'll read down through verse 11. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. And now to the New Testament, the book of James. The book of James, chapter 4, we'll begin reading at verse number 13. Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. And before you leave that passage, I want you to look, and in your mind at least, underscore one interesting phrase. When he says in verse number 14, you know not what will happen tomorrow. In the Ecclesiastes passage we read, that which is so familiar to so many, the idea that life is filled, and we might even say fraught, with seasons of various kinds. There's a time for one thing and a time for another, but they don't happen at the same time, and we never are quite sure when the new season is coming, when the old season is ending. And that's the idea that Solomon is getting to in Ecclesiastes 3, that these seasons that come and go in one's life are real, they can be expected, they're going to happen, but we don't know what God does. We make our plans, and sometimes those plans are dashed upon rocks of reality. But God knows. He's put in our hearts eternity, this sense that there's something beyond just this life. But in terms of God's doings, we might say doors he opens, providence he shows, and his plan otherwise he bears upon the world, as Paul says in the book of Acts chapter 17, he has set the boundaries of the nations. All the plans and workings of God are his business. Some of these he's revealed to us, but the secret things still belong to him, as Deuteronomy 29 and verse 29 tells us. And so bottom line from Ecclesiastes 3 is this. We know life is fraught with change. Various seasons we don't know always or ever. Do we, ahead of time, what those changes are and when they're going to occur? Which is the foundation to understanding the passage from James. We know a lot. And sometimes a lot we know gets us in trouble because we think we know more than we do, those of us living in the 21st century. It's amazing, it's staggering of the mind to realize things that we know now, that our parents and grandparents and their parents and grandparents did not know and couldn't even have imagined. I'm not talking about fanciful things of theory. I'm talking about actual things we know and can make use of. Because of our knowledge of some of the surface aspects of the laws of quantum physics, we've got the cell phone that we use, and your smartphone, you'd be hard-pressed to tell me why it does what it does. And I'm not just pointing the finger at you. I'd be just as hard-pressed as you to tell you why it does what it does. There are some things going on there I don't understand, but we've learned to harness whatever it is we've harnessed to make it work. We know some things, and it made those things workable, which those of generations past couldn't even have imagined. And what is true with your smartphone is true across the range of so many different areas of your life. We know so much now, but there's one thing we still don't know, and for many it just drives them crazy. As James says, we don't know what will happen tomorrow. Now, the next moment or two is just for Marquita. Marquita, do you know why we like football or any sport for that reason? We don't know before the event takes place what's going to happen. Now, I know from your perspective you fall down and jump on one another, but I'm talking about the actual score and how the game goes. The reason sports are interesting to so many is because you don't know. It doesn't matter what your team has done in the past, what you think it's going to do this time, what's going to happen. You do not know before the game starts what's going to happen in that game, which is, in a sense, a microcosm for life itself. And I'm not saying that you have to understand sports to really appreciate life. I am saying, though, that what makes sports so interesting to so many is the very thing that makes life and the fabric of it so real day to day. We don't know what's going to happen next. And what James is warning about here is the arrogance of acting as if you do. The arrogance of thinking you know something you don't know. We have a hard enough time really knowing things we need to know in the present tense. I said that we know so much, but you realize there's so much we still don't know. In fact, every time we find or figure something out that helps us know something, that helps us to build or create or invent something that changes life for the better, sometimes the worse, the very understanding that brought us to the point of building or creating this new thing we have created at least a dozen or more questions we didn't have before we got there. And even though we have the new knowledge, we've got more questions than answers when all is said and done. And hopefully over time we answer some of those which bring more questions to mind. And there's so much we do not know. We just don't. In the present tense. But I'll tell you, we know a lot more about the present than we do the future. Because as we didn't need James to tell us when he says we do not know what tomorrow will bring, we didn't need James to tell us that. If we just were honest with ourselves, we would realize, no, we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And so the picture that James paints is a scenario that happens all too often. And it's somewhat like the story Jesus tells in Luke 12 about the rich farmer. If not taken too far or to the extreme, there's really no harm, no foul, no problem, no difficulty with what's being done. It's pushing the matter to a point of becoming wrong. And we'll get back to James in just a minute, but that rich farmer in Luke 12, you remember Jesus is answering a demand that came his way. Speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me. Christ warns of covetousness. This is the 12th chapter of Luke. Jesus says, take heed of covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. And then he tells a story of the man, a farmer, who has such a bumper crop that he has a problem. He's got more produce than he has place to put it. Well, so far, no problem there. He's been blessed immensely. So he says, well, I'll do this. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger barns. And even there, that happens all the time. You have an increase in what you have coming in. You have to create some space to put that. And so he builds bigger barns in his mind. He has decided to build bigger barns. And then I will say to myself, self, and here's when he starts digging his hole. Self, I have many goods laid up for many years. I'll say to myself, eat and drink and be merry. Well, the fact is, as you know, as Jesus continues the story, that night his very soul was required of him. He left this life and all the goods he had behind. He left his plans for the barns and his old barns behind. He left everything he had in mind that was coming up in his future behind. And his soul was required, and he left everything behind. Now, if you'd asked that rich farmer a day before all this happened, before he realized what a wonderful crop he had coming in and all the goods and produce he had to deal with, if you'd ask him before all that happened, what's going to happen next, he couldn't have told you. Then he has the windfall. What are you going to do next? Well, I'm going to do this. And then, I know I've got the rest of my life set now. And that's where it goes too far. The problem with the rich farmer is not even planning for the future. If you've read the book of Ecclesiastes, and especially in this respect, the book of Proverbs, you know that God encourages wisdom that looks beyond the here and now to the future of one's life and to the plans in one's life going forward. Solomon encourages that. That's not the problem with the rich farmer, is that he's so wrapped up in his stuff, his monetary wealth, that he assumes arrogantly that that's his and will be his and will take care of him from that point forward, as if to say, nothing can get me now. I have no problems going forward. Everything is supplied to me because of what I have in terms of my stuff, my wealth. He took it for granted. The very opposite of what James suggests that we ought to do every day of our lives. You know, when he talks about here, this person saying, you know, I think, and I'm paraphrasing just a bit here, you know, I think today or maybe tomorrow I'll go over to such a city and I'll buy and sell. I'll do a business, get some gain. The only problem with that is not just the planning of it, but leaving God out of it. You notice he says, whereas you ought to have said, if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this or that. And then he suggests that that plan, with God missing from it, is pride and arrogance and boasting. As if to say, I know what the future is, and this is it. If you've read the Bible lately, and I know all of you have, you know there's story after story of people that are doing things and involved in things, good and bad, they didn't see coming. They just couldn't have predicted them. You remember the story of Abram and Sarai, They'll later be known as Abraham and Sarah. At and around the century mark, she bearing on top of that, no children, and God says you're going to have a child, and from that child you'll have such progeny that the entire world has a population of your family more so than the stars in heaven or the sands on the seashore. Well, they didn't see that coming. And of course, God said it, and God meant it, and God had it to happen. But they didn't see that coming. It was out of left field, as it were. A little bit later in the Bible, you read in the next book, in Exodus, in the very early part of that book, the story of Moses and how he's saved by God's providence. He flees for his life at the age of 40. He spends 40 years in Midian. He has a family. He's working with his father-in-law there. And he's completely content and happy in what he's doing. And if you told him any time during that 40 years, you know what you're going to do in the last third of your life? You're going to go back to Egypt and lead all those people out. And lead them through a barren land with God's provision to the very cusp of Canaan itself. He'd say, well, you're crazy. That's not going to happen. But it did. Sometimes we have the luxury of seeing these stories in hindsight as they've already played out. And we just assume, well, of course that's what happened, because that's what happened. If you put yourself in the place of the people living them, whether it's Abram and Sarai or here in the case of Moses, put yourself in their place at the time, in the present moment. Every plan they might have had in their minds about the future was completely dashed. That's not the way it happened. And those are stories of good. There are examples. You go forward still further in the Old Testament, you find two kings separated by some time, but both ending their lives in the same ugly fashion. The first, Saul, son of Kish, and the second, Ahab, the husband of Jezebel. And both of them are warned. I think Saul has some real fear about the battle they're both going into. Again, removed by years, but the same thing happens. God has in mind for them to die, and they do. But both of them are blindsided by it. In Saul's case, does everything he can think of to save himself from what is certainly coming. And those stories teach the same things Abram and Sarai and Moses do, and that is, we don't know the future. When we think we do, and we don't, whether in language used or at least in a mindset held, if we don't acknowledge the fact that it's up to God, if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this or that. Anything outside of that, aside from that, is brash and arrogant assumption. And I know that we live in a very culture so based upon security and safety and hedging your bets and getting double and triple the insurance you need to make sure that every particular and possible outcome can be foreseen and taken care of ahead of time, which is a downfall of modern thinking. Because even without the Bible, we know. We've seen examples. We've lived through examples where things have happened we didn't see coming. Sometimes there are no answers to the why questions. Things just happen. And before they happened, we couldn't have ever foreseen them. It's probably best we didn't know about them. I always remember that sermon of Brother John Bannister years ago, the sermon entitled, "The Blessing of Not Knowing." And it was about the fact that we're so much better off not knowing the future. Well, we don't. The problem is when we think we do. And we live life as if we don't need God. And as if He's not really in control. As if we have charge of everything. And that Notice again James' language. He says, but now you boast in your arrogance, all such boasting is evil. I need not remind us again, the first of those things God hates is a proud look. Proverbs 6. The first of things God loves, those beatitudes, concerns a poverty-stricken spirit, humility. The very absence of humility, the very picture of a proud look is saying, I know what's going to happen tomorrow, and years of tomorrow is coming up. I've got things mapped out for my life, and I know what's going to happen next. And God says that's arrogance. That's pride. And as another passage in Proverbs says, what goes before destruction and a fall? But pride. Sometimes pride is not shaking the fist at God and saying, I'll do it my way. Sometimes pride is just saying, I'm fine like I am. I don't need God. I can go through life and I know what's going to happen next. Well, let's not live that way. Let's plan, let's prepare, let's be wise, but let's also always, at least in mind and in attitude, understand God knows. We don't. We trust Him. We're not nearly as much in charge as we might think we are. The best we can do is submit to Him and to His will. And say, if the Lord will, if the Lord will, if the Lord will, we'll live and do this or that. If you're here tonight and subject to the Lord's invitation, please don't let this opportunity pass, but come as together we stand and sing.